Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping the future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with the stories that matter. And coming up on the program, could the Gaza ceasefire deal falter at the finish line? Runaway private healthcare costs, a new debate has been started. Why sustainable agriculture must be made a priority in South Africa as AgriSA doubles down on land expropriation opposition. And behind the surge in demand for luxury properties along the Cape's southern seaboard. It's Wednesday, the 26th of February. Now, I think it's fair to say that food security in South Africa is at risk. We've got climate change, there are water shortages, and the ongoing land pressure debate, making it harder for farmers to meet demand, while global supply chain disruptions have also highlighted the need for self-sufficiency. So at the B20 summit, AgriSA is now calling for urgent investment in sustainable farming. But here's my question. Are policymakers and big agribusinesses truly committed to the changes that are needed? In fact, what changes are needed? In that respect, I'm joined now by Johan Kortzer, who's the Chief Executive Officer of AgriSA. Johan, a very warm welcome to you. So the biggest immediate threat to South Africa's food security right now, what is it?
Well, for us at AgriSA, it's property rights. Because the moment that you put pressure on property rights through the new bill that was signed by our president, you kind of disturb the investor's mindset for agriculture. And it starts with farmers, and then it goes further to people in banking and capital raise, the raise of capital. So that would be the first one. The second one is more than just this one policy. I think there's a lot of policies that need to be modernized to make sure that we keep our food security, I would say, championship that we have in Africa. I don't know if you know that we actually one of the few countries in Africa that are food secure. So that's the second one. The third one is maybe something different. I think we focus on policy and we put a lot of effort into this to make sure that we keep policy at bay to food security. But the most important thing is, and I think that's what the vibe I got from the B20 was, what can we do as individuals on farms? What can we do as a food system where other businesses also join in, more than just looking at policy? And I think that excites me the most, that we can do more than what we do now, even though we're batting against some policies.
What kind of thinking is on the table then in that respect when you talk about doing more?
Yeah, I think geopolitics was one. With what we have now, and specifically America, I think it was a bit of a topic. And in this, the beauty is that Africans are good with making jokes. We had a few good jokes regarding that. However, geopolitics, everybody agreed that there should be, and there's going to be new ways of cooperation. So multilateral trade that we had in the past is going to be, to a certain extent, be modernized in the new era that we move in. And the concept that came up was collaboration for better futures. So even though it's happening with us now, and we're in the midst of a geopolitical issue with, say, America and all the other things that goes with it, what we discovered there is to say, but we need to look for new ways. It might be that that's the end of eras that for what we were used to, and how does the new future look like? So geopolitical impact on agriculture needs to be revisited to say, but how can we mitigate a possible risk? And I think that was one of the aspects that were highly debated at the B20.
So, Johan, if it's all about collaboration, then what specifically does the South African agricultural community need to do in order to stay on top of and lead that debate if necessary?
If we take energy, energy is not just an agricultural concept. It's far greater than that. Energy logistics is two good examples. So collaboration is when you get all the relevant parties together to say, but how do we solve the energy crisis in South Africa, of which agriculture is a big off-taker? And then you collaborate for a better future, a better outcome. Simplistically said, I think it's you get minds together that were not used to be together in the past, but because we've done our own thing. Mining was, to a certain extent, on their own concept, and they dealt with their own issues. So I think the first thing that I took out of this B20 was the collaboration of solving a problem rather than who we are was the focus point for me. Although I'm agriculture and I push for agriculture, the concept is how do we solve the energy crisis? So the focus shift is future-wise, and it is how do we solve this problem?
The other big push, I understand, at the B20 was the ongoing push for sustainability, but it's a difficult one for the farming sector, I would imagine, because you've got to find a balance between sustainability on the one hand, but you're also dealing with the reality of rising production costs. Part of that, of course, is within the energy mix.
Yeah, I think it was a big discussion. And what was interesting is when they spoke about sustainability, the first thing they said is versus economic growth. And I think what I also understood out of this whole concept is there's a lot of pragmatic thinking that you just can't take from the one and think the other one is going to grow. You need to understand the complexity thereof and look for a better kind of outcome for sustainability and economic growth. It's good to say we need to be more sustainable. Let's say, for instance, fertilizer use, and we have a law, and this law is going to drive sustainability, but my total production is going to come down, or my production efficiency is decreasing. Then you're going to sit with hunger. Then you're going to defeat then the object of food security. So I think the thinking is far greater than what we had in the past. It's if the activism is more for a collaborative outcome where you kind of say, but there's a much bigger picture to this, which for us as farmers is a big win.
Johan, just in conclusion, I want to circle back to land expropriation if we can. You spoke to me at the beginning of this conversation about uncertainty. You spoke about the potential of either disinvestment or a reluctance to invest, given that all of this is very opaque at the moment. Are you starting to see evidence of that?
The evidence is in the mind of our farmers. And right or wrong, I see that people are hesitant. We can see that people are arguing it, and it goes much further than just the expropriation bill itself. It goes now further than the norm. It goes into politics. And that's the first reaction they are. But that's where you don't want to be, because the largest investors in South Africa's agriculture are the farmers themselves. And the moment that you have uncertainty and people don't want to invest in what they do in future, you kind of claw back on the capability we have to be food secure. So I think we're going to get over this. In saying that is we will not give in on property rights and private property rights. We will, as AgriSA, not stop to oppose the concept of the bill because we believe it is not good for agriculture, and we said it from day one. However, what I do see is I see that we kind of are in this motion to say we've overcome so many things in the past. We will also get an outcome for this for the better of South Africa.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Johan Kotzer, who's the Chief Executive Officer of AgriSA.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, it seems the fragile ceasefire deal in Gaza is hanging by a thread. Israel is dragging its feet on releasing Palestinian prisoners while violence in the West Bank is escalating. There are also new reports of humanitarian issues in Gaza, many children dying from hypothermia and starvation. Is the ceasefire then destined to collapse, or maybe there is still some hope for a breakthrough? And if the deal fails, who stands to gain from the continued bloodshed? Let's update you on this important global story. I'm in conversation now with Zinat Adam, who is Deputy Executive Director at the Afro Middle East Center. Zinat, welcome to you. What does Israel gain from delaying prisoner releases? And is this a sign that maybe it didn't intend to honor the full agreement?
I think that it is worth noting that we're just days away from the end of the first phase of the ceasefire agreement, and with the hope of entering into the second phase. Now, the delays that Israel has implemented in the last few days since the last exchange may indicate to us that they are trying to utilize that as leverage. Benjamin Netanyahu has said that he's doing so because he wants an end to what he terms the humiliating parade of the hostages before them being handed over. But I think that this is also an affront in terms of the PR, and that Hamas, as the resistance in Gaza, has put on these shows in the hostage releases, and this has actually worked in their favor. It's done so in two ways, in the sense that it's still shown a strong resistance in terms of their numbers and being able to come out, and secondly, the kind of relationship that appears to have been formed with the hostages over the last 1.5 years. And that there seems to have been a little bit of a softening. Now, one of the things that the Israeli government has held on to is the release of the Bibas family in their coffins. This has been a very sensitive issue, both in Tel Aviv as well as in Gaza. In Tel Aviv, we will remember that the Bibas family, from the very outset, at the start of this war, were vehement that the Israeli government should immediately implement a ceasefire and have the release of hostages. And they were at the forefront of those protests in Tel Aviv. Since they have received the bodies of their family members, they have not wanted any of the Israeli politicians to come to their family home or to the funeral. And that really is showing their stance as families of the hostages. I think it really makes a difference in terms of the Israeli politic. But where the negotiations are right now is that we've seen the United States envoy flying to Egypt and possibly moving on to Qatar in the next couple of days. There's an intensification in the negotiations over the ceasefire towards the implementation of the second phase. And Israel is quite strongly standing on the idea of not withdrawing from Gaza within the second phase, which would have been part of the agreement.
There has been talk, or there have been reports of Hamas itself stalling negotiations. Do you believe they are genuinely still committed to a ceasefire?
Some of the stalling that's coming from the Hamas side relates to the non-delivery of humanitarian aid and what has been agreed upon. So there's been very drip aid that has been coming in and that Israel has been allowing into the Gaza Strip. The other thing that has been slow in being allowed into the Gaza Strip are the bulldozers to try and start removing the rubble. There was an agreement of up to 500 bulldozers being allowed, and there's only been about 5 from my recollection. So they withholding in terms of the agreement pending the delivery of humanitarian aid. And this is absolutely necessary. Tents have not been coming in the amounts that are needed. And that's affecting, as you've said in your introduction, the cost of life, where children have been exposed to the elements and have died from hypothermia, from starvation, simply because they're not able to access that aid. The other difficulty that has been experienced by the people in Gaza is that the aid reaches a certain point along the border, and then there is an expectation that the Palestinians deploy trucks to go and retrieve that. But there is a lack of sufficient trucks to be able to do so within the Gaza Strip, and those that are on the other side are not being permitted in.
Is there a sense then that the international community is abandoning or has abandoned its responsibility for increased humanitarian intervention?
I think that there is, behind the scenes, a lot of diplomatic work that is being done. Certainly since the announcement by President Trump that he would like to turn the Gaza Strip into a Riviera and remove most of the Palestinians, or all of the Palestinians from there, relocate them into Jordan and into Egypt. Now, the Arab states have been very much against this idea of a complete displacement of Palestinians from their homes, noting that this has happened previously, and there have been promises in previous agreements over decades that Palestinians would be allowed to return. So there's a lot of caution around whether or not that idea would be something that could be implemented. And a few days ago, most of the Arab leaders met in Riyadh. What they are trying to do is to revive the Arab Peace Initiative of 2002, which looks at the formation of a two-state solution with a Palestinian state and an Israeli state side by side in secure borders. That is going to be difficult to implement, but what they are proposing on the cards is a normalization of relations with Israel from all parties in this region.
And just very quickly, if the ceasefire fails, what are the chances of another all-out war within weeks or months?
It's really concerning that if we're looking at an all-out war, there are a few factors that are worrying. Number one is that while there has been the ceasefire in Gaza, there still has been fire, and at least 140 people have been killed during the ceasefire. The second is that there are greater incursions by the occupying power of Israel into refugee camps on the West Bank, such as Jenin, where 40,000 people have been additionally displaced from their homes. The third, last night, for example, there was extreme bombing into the Syrian areas from Israel into Syria. And the bombing continues in Lebanon. So this greater expansion of the war is of massive concern. And I think that most of these Arab states are trying to prevent that from escalating even further. So the initiatives around the diplomatic movements and the implementation of phase two of the ceasefire, and then looking beyond that to the post-war Gaza governance and rebuilding and reconstruction, is going to be extremely critical in the next few weeks.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Inad Adam, Deputy Executive Director at the Afro Middle East Center.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, recent findings from South Africa's Health Market Inquiry reveal that private healthcare costs have become prohibitively expensive for so many of us. I'm going to talk now to Dr. Rajesh Patel, head of health system strengthening at the Board of Healthcare Funders, and he's been vocal about the urgent need for regulatory reform to address a pressing issue for many of us. Dr. Patel, a very warm welcome to you. Before we talk about regulatory reform, maybe just remind us what the primary factors are contributing to the increasingly high costs of private healthcare.
I think the starting point is to look at what healthcare is, and to put that in the context of the Competition Commission involvement or interference back in 2003-2004. I think firstly, for South Africa, we have a constitutional mandate, particularly in the Bill of Rights, which goes along the lines of access to healthcare services. And there's a byline that says to the extent affordable. And obviously, in 2003, Competition Commission got involved, and we were a bit disappointed. And the reason why we need to look at this is, why was the Competition Commission getting involved in healthcare, which is, you know, the access to which is supposed to be a constitutional mandate? And I think the bottom line is they looked at this as low-hanging fruit. They looked at healthcare services as a commodity, which is fundamentally flawed. A commodity is something that you would know about and you can make a willing choice whether you want to buy it or not. Healthcare, unfortunately, like other social services and, you know, like bread, milk, etc., there's no negotiation about it. It's a need for everyone to have, including healthcare. And therefore, the theory of competition and price movement related to commodities doesn't necessarily apply. In fact, the reverse applies. Because these are things that are in need, and when things are in need and there's demand for it, prices actually start going up. And this is what actually happened when the Competition Commission started to get involved and said the BHF could not negotiate with, you know, the various service providers, and between BHF, Hospital Association, the Medical Association got fined for doing negotiations. So that's led to the starting point of significantly higher increases than what we would have done if we were allowed to negotiate. And particularly after 2003-2004, then after the period of 2009-2011, when there was a court case and they took the Department of Health to court, you saw bigger increases. And this is the critical component, is that because it's something that is a demand for and there's no protection for the public, even for regulated benefits in the private sector, that the prices keep going up and up. And that's why we've been demanding for regulatory intervention, that we need to protect the public with price regulation. Similarly, the way we have electricity regulations, water pricing being regulated, etc.
So in other words, what I'm hearing you say is that things would improve if we had more structured tariff setting.
That's one element that would contribute towards the system strengthening. There's a whole lot of other things that obviously need to be done, but you spot on the mark. That is definitely one of the things that would contribute, particularly in an environment where government has got sort of a regulated benefit in place. What we're talking about, whether it's a regulated benefit, not a regulated benefit, it's a healthcare need. And therefore, you should have common pricing across the board. And the new arrangement they published on Monday recently on Friday, and the ministers talked about the other day, is going that extra mile that says it will be for both regulated and the unregulated healthcare services.
And in your opinion, is that concept still achievable? Is there still room for negotiation in that respect?
I think at this point in time, anything that you get from government that's in the right direction, I think we must grab it and probably work collectively to make it happen. Will this thing that they published, what the Competition Commission published, will it be available to the public and will they benefit from it, say, in the next 6 months to a year? Probably not, because they've got to set up all the infrastructure and things and mechanisms, and because they talk about a determination method to come up with that maximum regulated pricing. I think that's going to be a long way away. You know, to me, what BHF, this, the whole thing was triggered by BHF applying for exemption. Some of the service providers came through. Last year, December, we received a letter to say your exemption application has been rejected. What we're asking for is let us negotiate with willing providers. That will provide more certainty. It will even help regulatory bodies to determine whether providers are charging reasonable or not. Unfortunately, it was rejected. And we were actually told, no, you don't have a problem, but the medical schemes are financially fine. You're growing the market. You know, there's enough membership in the environment. So everything is fine. And suddenly you hear the minister saying, oh, healthcare costs are going wild. It needs to be controlled. Mm-hmm. So there's a bit of contradiction between what Competition Commission replied to us in our exemption application and what the minister said. But we need solutions.
Dr. Patel, I sense the key phrase there is willing providers. Do you think that there is sufficient consensus as far as that is concerned to reach the kind of agreement that you're proposing?
Maybe not. I mean, at the moment, without any regulation, everyone seems to be having a party. So, you know, with regulated benefits, you need to force people around to the table to get to find solutions that are mutually acceptable to all, that are fair and reasonable for providers, but also affordable to members of medical scheme. That's where we need to go. Is this proposal good enough? Definitely not, because they're excluding all health facilities. That health facilities represent 50 to 60% of healthcare costs. Medicines make up another, say, 15, 20%. So what are you negotiating on with providers kind of thing for that 20, 30% out there? So I think, you know, they've called for comments. We will definitely pool our thoughts together, make sure we submit our comments through. But I think we need to make it mandatory for all those involved in healthcare to be part of this negotiation framework. And in fact, in the short term, to allow us the exemption to start negotiating with as many providers as possible that are willing to seek solutions out there.
And if the status quo, Dr. Patel, continues, healthcare, private healthcare, essentially becomes a luxury item.
It would definitely become. It's getting there at this point in time. Many people are dropping off medical schemes or cannot afford to belong to medical schemes. And I think, you know, it'll be unfortunate if government don't come to the party. And they should have been doing this right from 1996 when the Constitution was signed into law and there was the Bill of Rights being put out there.
But of course, government's focus, Dr. Patel, is more on NHI, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the whole unfortunate issue. But there seems to be a recognition in the short term, and maybe it's because of the government of national unity, that we need to start fixing what we have right now. And I think that's the important thing is we have a lot of assets in this country, both in the public sector and definitely in the private sector. We don't want to wish these kind of resources away and try a whole new thing. What we need to do is to build that NHI on top of what we already have at this point in time.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks, Dr. Patel. Unfortunately, I am out of time. That is Dr. Rajesh Patel, Head of Health System Strengthening at the Board of Healthcare Funders. Thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, while South Africa's economy battles slow growth and high unemployment, the ultra-luxury property market is telling a very different story. Multi-million rand homes along Cape Town's southern seaboard are in high demand, international buyers leading the charge, no surprise there. But is this a sustainable trend? Are we looking maybe at a bubble that might burst at some point? What does it mean for affordability in the broader property market? I'm going to talk now to Basil Moraitis, who is regional head of Pam Golding Properties in the area. Basil, a very warm welcome. So why is the luxury property market booming while the rest of the country's economy is struggling?
Well, Jeremy, it's all to do with supply and demand. It's a phenomenon that's happening in many cities in the world where you have prime real estate and they're just not creating any more of it. And Cape Town has truly been discovered. There's a lot to offer in Cape Town. The values by comparison with international properties are low when you look at what you can get in prime locations in London and in many other cities. We're giving our properties away when you look at the values that we're achieving. And there are some high values, but you're achieving an exceptional lifestyle for that.
And the main buyers, Basil, South Africans, expatriates, or foreign investors looking for safe haven assets? I guess when it comes to South Africans, in many respects, are out of their price range, or at least for many of them.
Well, not at all. We have many buyers from upcountry who've been securing some of the luxury properties. In fact, we put out a press release recently where a 46 million rand property sold in Clifton last month went to a local buyer. One of the bungalows for 46.5 million to a buyer from Germany, and a UK buyer bought a house in Kemps Bay for 55 million. So it's very much local buyers. Part of our market has always been the expats who left many years ago and now want the lifestyle again and are returning. They're very active in our market. But what has fundamentally changed over the years, Jeremy, is that initially in 20, 25 years ago when I first started in property, there weren't many international, true international buyers in the Cape Town market. It was mostly driven by locals from upcountry and also by our returning expat buyers. Today, Cape Town has been discovered, as I've said, and the international buyers who are coming in are true international buyers who, through word of mouth and friends and family, are buying properties here because of what they can get in the lifestyle. And the rest of the world is actually a mess. If you look at our problems compared to what's happening in the rest of the world, I think that Cape Town has a lot to offer.
Do you think, Basil, the surge in the high-end property demand market is maybe widening inequality in the real estate sector, particularly in that province?
You know, we would all like to live on the doorsteps of Buckingham Palace or in Monaco. The reality is that there's always going to be segments of the market which are going to be priced in international terms. It happens everywhere. The mayor's done a good job, and I know you're probably talking around the issue of affordable housing. That is an aspect which the mayor has taken to heart, the city has taken to heart, and which we fully support and endorse affordable housing in well-located areas. But there are going to be your areas which are not designed for affordable housing. And those areas happen, as in many countries in the world, happen to be, just as I said, in Monaco, in central London, happen to be the jewels in the crown. And people do expect to pay more for them.
Is there a sense at some point that this market could become overheated and eventually crash?
Well, no. Why don't we look at the records and go back 20 or 25 years? And I've printed out some stats for you. And I've looked at, for instance, in Clifton, and let's take Clifton bungalows as an example. In 1994, a bungalow sold, and I've got it in front of me, I'm not going to give you the names or anything, just the sizes, a 370 square meter piece of land sold for 742,000. Then in the early 2000s, they were trading for about 1,200,000 to 3,000,000. Here's an example of a bungalow that sold, the exact bungalow it sold in 2001 for 3 million, and it was sold last year for 60 million. So this is a trend that's been going on over the years. It's been sustained. We've been through three periods that I can think of over the history. So in the early 2000s, the market was very bullish. South Africa was doing very well until the global credit crunch. The prices went up significantly. Then in 2008, the global crunch, the markets came down a bit. From 2014, the Cape Town market seems to have decoupled from the rest of the country, and prices went up considerably until 2019. We had COVID. And then after COVID, the prices have just escalated again post-COVID. So it's been a sustainable trend. Unless they start making more Cliftons and more prime coastal real estate, I don't see this bubble bursting. There'll be corrections. There'll be ups and downs, as there always are. But the long-term trajectory is there, and the markets are solid.
That almost segues into my next question. We're talking about the southern seaboard in Cape Town, but what about the rest of the city?
The rest of the city is also, there's a shortage of stock. We talk about the Atlantic seaboard, not necessarily just the southern seaboard, it's the Atlantic seaboard. The rest of the city is also short of stock. There's been a lot of semigration into Cape Town. We haven't built enough new single residential housing for the markets, and there's a shortage of stock, and that's why the prices are going up.
I'm also interested to know what role, if any, platforms like Airbnb play in driving up luxury property prices. There are good returns here.
There are good returns. It's a feature of the market. The Airbnb is quite an important part of our market, in our investor market. And it does contribute to the desirability of properties by investors, but it's not the very top end of the market. At the very top end of the market, your returns don't justify the capital investment. It's the capital growth you're going for and not the yield.
I'm going to leave it there. Basil Moraitis, thank you very much indeed. He is regional head at Pam Golding Properties. Appreciate your time today. And that concludes our program for today. We'll be back tomorrow with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.